Hi, I'm Advas Haldinger, and you're listening to DevEx at the World Bank and IMF meetings, a special edition of This Week in Global Development. Every year in spring and fall, finance ministers, civil society organizations, and private sector financiers gather at the World Bank and IMF meetings to discuss the state of the global economy. This year's spring meetings take place as a large number of countries face debt distress and high interest rates that make it difficult for them to borrow money to pursue key development-related projects. Low-income countries in particular are struggling to recover after the COVID-19 pandemic. With this year marking the 80th anniversary of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, a key question is whether these organizations are still fit for purpose given today's global challenges. And what happens, especially at the World Bank, often sets the tone for the whole multilateral development bank system and beyond. Over the next few episodes, I'll be digging into how these conversations are playing out at the bank's spring meetings in Washington, D.C. The World Bank is in a time of transition. 18 months ago, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen kicked off a push for reforms, launching what the World Bank calls its evolution process. The bank's new mission statement, to end extreme poverty and boost shared prosperity on a livable planet, was approved in October, and it officially expands the bank's mission to include climate change. More than a year into its reform process, a number of efforts to stretch the bank's existing funding are underway. These changes are unfolding as the World Bank goes to its donors this year to ask for more money to replenish the International Development Association, or IDA, its fund for the poorest countries. In today's episode, we take a look at how these reforms are going and what ideas are out there for what more the institution could do to adapt and change. Clemence Landers is a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development. I asked her to help us get the lay of the land about what's happened since the bank launched its reform agenda.
There have been a significant amount of changes at the institution, and I would start in particular with one of the most notable ones, which is the change in leadership. With Ajay Banga's arrival, there's just been an enormous amount of activity underway at the institution. The bank has actually changed its mission statement to a world free of poverty on a livable planet. So that really kind of sets the agenda for the bank of moving towards this idea of focusing much more on global public goods. The reform agenda has these three prongs. One prong that's simply really focused on increasing the availability of financing. The quantum of financing that the World Bank is providing. So the centerpiece of that has been the capital adequacy review, the capital adequacy framework, which is really focused on the term that everyone uses around this is squeezing more juice out of the lemon. So a big part of that, and I'll get a teeny bit technical, but not too technical, is that the bank decided that it would lower its equity to loan ratio. So the floor from 22% to 19%. And that was going to be enable the bank to free up about $50 billion in new lending over the next 10 years. And they've also launched a whole new kind of host of instruments that can enhance their overall lending. So one of these is the shareholder guarantees, which have been employed often for countries to allow the bank to increase its lending headroom for certain countries, notably Ukraine. So far, I wouldn't say that there's been tremendous, you know, a sense of a tremendous expansion in the overall portfolio. It takes a while to build up on the equity side. So, for instance, the bank's equity to loan ratio is still about 22%. And then on the guarantee side and on the hybrid capital side, the ball is really in the court of the shareholders to come forward with those instruments. And so I think one of the questions that's really on the table is, you know, the bank is kind of saying, well, we've stretched, we're squeezing the juice out of the lemon, and we've launched all of these new instruments, but, you know, we still are pretty far off from where we would like to be. in terms of the financing that's needed, especially for the climate transition in a lot of upper middle income countries. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to kind of see if and when the bank will be pushing for capital increase conversations. And that's, of course, hard when you're in a period where there's a couple of big transitions and big shareholder governments underway.
It seems like the focus of the spring meetings will likely be more on IDA replenishment. And so I guess the question is, do you think that the bank at this point is sort of going to wait until after IDA replenishment to even think about sort of a broader capital increase?
Yeah, I mean, the sequencing of all of this is going to be really, really critical and really important. And as you pointed out, we're in an IDA replenishment year. So the IDA provides financing to for the world's poorest countries, and replenishing IDA is a big, big lift. IDA requires about $25 billion from donors a cycle. So it's a very, very big funding mechanism. You know, so generally in an IDA year, the bank keeps most of the pressure and most of the focus on IDA. The bank stops fundraising for even its trust funds and other windows, and it's really, really solely focused on IDA. And in particular, you know, I think it will be interesting to see what tone is set at the springs, because I think in a lot of ways it will be a little bit of a welcome shift to have a little bit more of the financing and the policy conversation around IDA. And this is in particular true because there's a certain amount of concern that a lot of the evolution discussions and a lot of the evolution debate has really focused on the IBRD and the financing needs of upper middle income countries.
And getting new funding for IDA or a broader capital increase won't necessarily be easy. I spoke with Representative French Hill, a Republican who represents the 2nd District of Arkansas and serves as the vice chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. He said that while there is support for IDA in the U.S. Congress, it's a difficult year politically to push through more funding. During a live DevEx event in Washington, D.C. earlier this year, I asked him what he thought of World Bank reforms thus far.
The new president is a dynamic person and a dynamic business executive with global experience. And he comes at it with that, as I say, that rule of law, capital markets, capital allocation, private sector mentality, which I think is healthy over at the bank. You need that sort of catalytic person at the head to try to move this giant machinery of the World Bank. Secretary Yellen, I think, has been supportive of that too. The most important thing they can do is obviously keep their credit rating high and be able to try to use that as leverage. And we've experimented there. I don't know that we've been as successful as we might be in extending the brand and extending that financial capability. But at the heart of it,
what more could they do?
I don't know. I mean, I think Secretary Yellen's talked about it. I mean, the ability to let them indirectly do more with that credit rating is a possibility. Their technical assistance, I think, is very, very valuable, maybe more valuable sometimes than the credit that they extend, honestly. But partnering is key, and they've got the elements to do that. And I think that's where Andrzej is potentially headed. And he also wants to make sure he's delivering value, and that gets into the bureaucracy of decision-making on extending that credit under what terms and conditions. My view is to stay focused on the core mission of development and fighting poverty through development and being focused on that mission and not have mission creep. I think a bigger challenge personally for me over at the IMF than at the World Bank.
So what would it take to get more funding from the U.S. government? Representative Hill shared a few policy changes that U.S. politicians might look for as part of an IDA replenishment or capital increase.
Well, I think first, on all of the above, energy strategy for the Global South, I think, is important. I think graduation from China, from World Bank lending status might be something that someone on the Republican side of the aisle would be encouraging. Transparency on how the World Bank uses trust funds and how those are monitored would be an area I think that could be of interest, so that people know that who's sponsoring the trust fund, what's the transparency around it, what's the mission of it, does it have a sunset, will it end someday, or is this just an exercise in perpetuity? And then I think helping to link back to the big issues that you and I've talked about before, that both the bank and the IMF perform a function of insisting on transparency in sovereign lending to our most impoverished countries, and that we do not facilitate the kind of things that we read about at William and Mary's study of China's lending in their Belt and Road program to the Global South, where you have predatory pricing, you have hidden terms, you have conflicts of interest built in, you have requirements to use poor contractors with no record of success, or capturing a commodity basis for repayment and penalizing the country. These things should be enforced, in my judgment, through the World Bank and the IMF's ability to aid and design and use technical assistance with these countries that need the help the most. And those are the kinds of reforms that I'm talking about. Let's stay focused on the mission at hand, which is the health and well-being of people in our poorest countries in the world, and not be caught up with fads in New York, Washington, or Paris. And let's demand change and not be timid about it, and take the initiative to lead here. And this is a place where the United States can do that.
Hi, I'm Kate Warren, Executive Editor at DevEx. If you are listening to this podcast, you're likely working to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. But are you subscribed to DevEx Newswire? Global development can be a fast-moving, complex sector. Our team of global reporters work every day to bring you the news you need to make sense of it all. In DevEx Newswire, we keep you up to date on issues ranging from climate change financing, to gender equality, and global health, to transforming the food system, all in a fun-to-read, free newsletter delivered directly to you 5 days a week. Join the hundreds of thousands of global development professionals who receive DevEx Newswire, and visit devx.com/newsletters to sign up to this free newsletter today.
The World Bank recently released a Development Committee paper outlining how it plans to implement some of the additional reforms. It includes some of the bigger financial reforms, but also delves into operational and structural changes. There's discussion of a recently released new corporate scorecard, new grand challenge programs, a new knowledge platform, and more. The list of what they plan to do is long. So I asked Clemence Landers to help parse some of the details.
I think there's a lot in here, but there's a lot that remains very tantalizingly vague. A big part of the evolution is really this attempt to get the World Bank and the IBRD in particular to focus more on what shareholders are calling global challenges. And I think in a lot of ways, this was really born out of the fact that there was a feeling that the World Bank had sort of missed the boat in COVID. And part of it was that the World Bank model just really wasn't adapted to a global crisis. I think a lot of the evolution is an attempt to correct that, an attempt to fix that problem in the model. And I think then you kind of get into a lot of the theories of what went wrong in the bank, and what really needs to be changed so the bank can be useful to its clients. And I think you see a couple of these different theories tested out in this paper. So, you know, one of them is really that the bank is the core of the bank is that it's a demand-driven model. Part of this evolution roadmap is how do we bridge that gap between the national interest and the global interest? And part of it is around thinking of how do we incentivize countries to do things that to take on some of these global challenges where the positive global externalities are very strong. And part of the theory around this is that there needs to be more concessionality in the system. You really need to pay countries to do the right thing. So you have mention in here of something called the Livable Planet Fund, which is meant to be sort of a concessional financing vehicle that sits alongside the IBRD, that really is meant to provide incentives for countries to borrow for things that have big positive global externalities. So that's the pricing incentive and this kind of whole part of the global public goods window. And then kind of, I would say sitting beside that is this idea of a speed incentive. And this has been something that the President Bonga himself has really been speaking a lot about, of the need for the bank to move faster. And in particular, and here in this paper, there are some targets around the time it takes to just bring a project to the board, and really wanting to reduce that time from, I think it's something like 17 months to 12. And part of that is the feeling that a lot of countries are moving away from the bank or are less interested in borrowing from the bank simply because it operates too slowly. That's been a big focus of President Bonga's, is on this concept of kind of fixing the plumbing, as he calls it, and kind of moving forward with speed. And then I would just put in a third one alongside that is the volume incentives. And so on one side, you know, we were just talking about that of, you know, the hybrid capital and the guarantees and some of the internal changes the bank has made to its financing model to increase volume. But I'd also add to that private capital mobilization. And this has really also been kind of a big focus of President Bonga's, and he's created this private sector investment lab comprised of a lot of CEOs to really think about what it is that the World Bank could be doing to just bring in more private capital into projects. So how do you use the subsidy that the World Bank or parts of the World Bank group can provide to then bring in bigger quantums of private financing. And that's part of this paper as well.
To get a sense of what reforms could or should look like when it comes to private capital mobilization, I spoke to Stephanie von Friedeberg, Managing Director of Banking and Capital Markets Advisory at Citi, who also spent about 30 years at IFC.
We need to think about product reform, and that really goes back to there's a call for everyone to have more capital. And we know EBRD is getting a capital increase. We know IDB Invest is getting a capital increase. There's a good chance eventually the World Bank will get another capital increase. Getting more money into those institutions and deploying it in the same old way is not going to give us the multiplier that we need to make a difference. So we need to start thinking about product reform. And in my year at Citi, the thing that I've learned is neither the commercial and institutional investors nor the development finance institutions truly understand each other. They don't understand the strengths that each one can bring to the table if we could think collaboratively about how to solve some of these problems. If we can't build domestic capital markets that are deep enough and broad enough, we're never going to get the development funding we need. So I think we need to really think about that product development using mini perms and the balance sheets of the development institutions slightly differently than the way that they've done in the past. And that really takes, okay, here are my risks, here are your risks. How could we do this together as opposed to competing against one another?
Von Friedeberg told me that the World Bank Group and other multilateral development banks also need to think about how they're setting their key performance indicators and what sort of behaviors they are incentivizing. The system won't change if the right metrics are not in place, she told me.
The best example I can give you is that when you set a key performance indicator on climate that is using own account, what does that drive you to do? It drives you to do the biggest projects on your own balance sheet, even though there's an opportunity for you to bring someone else in on a commercial basis. If we can't have a dialogue where we say taxpayer money built these development institutions and we should now get value out of them by ensuring that we have the right regulatory environment and that we understand what the preferred creditor status brings, what an AB loan structure provides, what an AB bond might actually bring to investors in relation to the security of those investments, we're not going to get there.
One of the questions that I've been thinking about, especially with this latest Development Committee paper laying out a laundry list of priorities, is how many of these proposals are actually new? Or are they more of a repackaging of existing programs or policies with slight tweaks? So I asked Clemence whether the reforms to date are transformative or whether they are more limited changes aimed at being responsive to shareholders.
That is the question. And I think in a lot of ways, the proof will really be in the pudding, to kind of put it in those terms. And it will, you know, we'll have to see how this plays out over the next 5 years to decade. I mean, for a lot of people, I think that there was a feeling that the World Bank reform was going to be a sprint. And I think these things are always end up a little bit more being marathons than sprints. And this is an institution that's very hard to change. I mean, I feel like MDB reform kind of keeps coming up in the in international conversations as this perennial topic. There are a lot of things that are very familiar. This is not the first time the World Bank's revamped its corporate scorecard. This is not the first time, in a lot of ways, the global challenges, the global challenges areas of focus really kind of remind me in a way of Jim Kim's, global solutions areas. Private capital mobilization has been a white whale that has been around for a very long time. It used to be called the billions to trillions agenda. A lot of these things aren't new. And, within the institution, I think there's always been a certain amount of resistance to change. One of the things that concerns me the most in a way about this reform conversation is really trying to understand how much political consensus inside the board of the organization exists around this agenda. And I think in a lot of ways that will make or break this. And in particular, a lot of the countries that borrow from the bank are not particularly interested in having, rich country shareholders telling them how to borrow, what to borrow for. And the demand-driven nature of the institution is just such an intrinsic part of what has made this an important institution, that, any attempt to really kind of direct funds is something that, a lot of borrowing country shareholders have been very vocal about being concerned about.
There are some who argue that as these reforms play out, they are mirroring a dated power dynamic. When I spoke with Kevin Gallagher, the director of the Global Development Policy Center at Boston University earlier this year, he talked about the need for these changes to not just be driven by shareholders, but by the needs and wishes of borrower countries.
These things were created a long time ago in a different era. The United States and the Europeans basically have veto power over all decisions. And there's a gentleman's agreement that the head of the World Bank is always an American and the head of the IMF is always a European. And unfortunately, that still hasn't changed. I think as we look at this 80th anniversary, we have to realize that there's competition out there, that the MDBs are only about $4 trillion of the $23 trillion of development finance there. And some stakeholders like the Chinese have really entered this space in a really positive way. According to our research, the Chinese, since 2008, have brought about $500 billion into the development finance space. That's about around the same level in orders of magnitude as the World Bank. So China's added a World Bank out there. They do infrastructure where the World Bank had abandoned it. It's helped the World Bank and the MDBs move back into infrastructure. And so the good news is that we have healthy competition, but competition is there. And now there are alternatives for developing countries if the MDBs don't reform. And so we need to realize that there is an ecosystem here, but we need to coordinate. Healthy competition is good, but especially when in times of friction and crisis like this, if we don't coordinate, we can not meet the goals that we're all looking for. We have to agree on a set of goals, which is why I'm excited that the G20 is at the heart of this, because it's much more representative than the two the Western-backed, what Chris Humphrey calls legacy institutions that are run by the West. The G20, especially now with the African Union as a component of it, really represent about 90% of the world and can help us have a more balanced conversation about development finance. Making the system bigger is a big part of the agenda for the G20, but also making these institutions much better. They focus so much on project finance rather than transformational development finance. And that we can't think of this as one project at a time. They need to be part of coordinated policy frameworks from the ground up, from countries' needs. Different countries have different development needs and different financing needs that can't be one size fits all, and that we need to develop country platforms that all different kinds of investors can play a role in.
During the next few episodes, I'll be on the ground at the spring meetings in Washington, D.C., finding out how the bank plans to mobilize private capital and boost climate finance, what's at stake for IDA replenishment, and how conversations about everything from debt to multilateral coordination play out. Thanks for listening to DevEx at the World Bank and IMF Meetings, a special edition of This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it, or you can leave us a rating or review. We'd also love to hear from you if you have any feedback or want to get in touch. You can find me on social media at @advasal or send an email to podcast@devex.com. DevEx at the World Bank and IMF Meetings is hosted by me, Adva Saldinger. Today's episode was edited by Catherine Girardeau.